This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Future Farm Botanicals Liquid Wild Oil of Oregano with rosemary extract and natural honey flavor. Future Farm's Wild Oil of Oregano supports a variety of healthy benefits, including antimicrobial effects, as well as supporting the immune system. Plus, Future Farm is the first ever to formulate Wild Oil of Oregano with rosemary. Rosemary aids circulation, helps alleviate muscle pain, improves memory, and also gives your immune system a boost. The natural honey flavor enhances the taste while still giving you all of the benefits. For more information and to order, call 888-841-7216, 888-841-7216, or go to myfuturefarm.com/Hoffman. That's future, P-H-A-R-M, myfuturefarm.com/Hoffman. Wild oil of oregano is all natural, science-based, and works without adverse side effects. MyFutureFarm.com/Hoffman. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Today's podcast will be a deep dive into keto. We're going to talk about the low-carb, high-fat, carbohydrate-restricted diet with the author of a great new book, The Case for Keto. He's known to many of you. He's been a frequent contributor here on Intelligent Medicine because he's written some great books, starting in 2002, he wrote a very, very influential article in the New York Times Magazine. Some of you may recall it was a real game changer. It featured a big picture of a juicy T-bone steak on the cover of the New York Times Magazine with the headline, "What if it's all been a big fat lie?" And Gary Taubes has bucked the trend in nutrition for a long time as an investigative journalist, because the trend is towards avoiding fat, plant-based diets, low saturated fat, avoiding cholesterol. But on this theme, he's written several books, The Case Against Sugar, Why We Get Fat, and Good Calories, Bad Calories. And now he's written a wonderful compendium called The Case for Keto, Rethinking Weight Control, and the Science and Practice of Low-Carb, High-Fat Eating. Gary, it's a pleasure having you back on Intelligent Medicine. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Ron. It's great to be here.
And your book is really a very scholarly tour de force of investigative reporting. It really is a wonderful summation of the history of how we've approached obesity and where we've taken a wrong turn in terms of nutritional science. And, of course, you know and you point out in your book that the American Heart Association and the American College of Cardiology recently doubled down on their latest lifestyle guidelines, and they're not hospitable to low-carb eating or the introduction of meat and saturated fat. So what say you to that?
That's a good question. I constantly amazed by the cognitive dissonance in the field of medicine. So we have a medical research community said that's been advocating low-fat diets for 50 years now, vegetable oils instead of fats from animal sources, mostly plants or all plants now. And throughout that period, the populations they've been recommending for have gotten ever heavier, fatter, and more diabetic. So we've had, coincident with this advice, epidemic increases in the prevalence of obesity and diabetes. And if you're practicing family medicine in this day and age, or internal medicine, it means that your waiting room is full of people who suffer from obesity or diabetes or hypertension, which means they can't control their weight, or they cannot control their blood sugar, or they cannot control their blood pressure. And we have known for 200 years now that you can, in effect, fix this by restricting the carbohydrate content of the diet. So the carb carbohydrates are the problem, not the fats. And what I tried to do with this book is, explain that thinking. Why those of us who have come to embrace that thinking find it so compelling. And one of the things I did is I interviewed over 120 physicians who have come to think like this and who prescribe it to their patients. And my rough estimate is they are, you know, among the tens of thousands worldwide who have now made this shift. And what they see in their patients is their patients get healthy. So,
is it fair to say, and you point this out in the book, that nutrition science is dominated by the thinking of lean, healthy people? And they counsel moderation, and they rail against fad diets. You know, they just say, eat a plant-based diet, avoid junk. Maybe we should be more circumspect about our consumption of sugar and refined carbohydrates. What about that?
Well, so since the 1930s, when the American medical community, this wasn't the case in Europe, but in the U.S., the American community embraced this idea that the obesity is caused by excess consumption of calories. So what that means is that the only difference between lean people, people who can stay lean their whole life, and people who maybe start off lean but then become obese, is that the latter ate too much and the former didn't. And to me, this is kind of stunning, but this is still how the thinking goes today. And one of the articles I cite in the book is a New York Times article from a couple of years ago in which it was announcing a new gene that had been discovered that was linked to obesity. And they quoted a British researcher, very prestigious, saying, in effect, that the gene determines who will reach for the donuts. If a plate of donuts is put on a table in a, you know, in a meeting, the implication being the people who can't control their weight will reach for the donuts, and that's why they're fatter.
I'm pretty sure quite a lot of us have that gene.
Yeah, but the argument would be the gene doesn't make us reach for the donuts. The gene makes us accumulate fat. And so when we embrace this idea that obesity was a disorder of overeating, the obesity research community en masse turned away from the idea that it was a fat accumulation disorder. So those people, you know, if somebody won, you know, you have a friend or a sibling or a relative who weighs 250 pounds and you only weigh 150, you don't think of them as having an eating disorder or taking in more calories than they expend. You think of them as people who, for whatever reason, accumulate fat too easily and can't shed the fat they accumulate. So there had always been a counter argument that obesity is a fat accumulation disorder. It's a disorder of the hormones and enzymes that regulate fat accumulation, which weren't worked out until the 1960s. But by that time, the field of obesity was being dominated by psychologists and psychiatrists who were trying to figure out how to get fat people to eat less. Mm-hmm. So the whole science got perverted back in the 1930s. And what happened is you had all these lean physicians, lean, healthy doctors, who thought, well, I'm lean and I eat in moderation and I exercise. They actually may or may not have exercised back then, but we'll say they did. And therefore, if everybody ate in moderation like I do, and exercise like I do, they would be lean too. That's sort of a natural assumption. It's not true, but it's a natural assumption. So the diet advice we got were these lean physicians basically telling the rest of us that we should do what they do. And what they don't understand, I'm going to just finish this thought, then I'll... What they didn't understand, they don't understand, is that those of us who fatten easily, which is a kind of term used by the 1950s-era diet doctors, those of us who fatten easily will get fatter and be hungry if we eat like they do. So what works for them doesn't work for us.
And what's interesting, in the book, you often use the first person plural, we and us. So does this apply to you? Is this something that you've undergone experientially? Have you had a personal transformation around the low-carb paradigm?
Well, I think it applies to everyone eventually who buys into this. And that's, again, part of this thinking. If you're lean and healthy, let's say you're a 30-year-old physician, you've just come out of med school, you like to run marathons, and you're lean and you eat exactly the diet that the health authorities tell us to eat, which is fruits, vegetables, whole grains, beans, legumes, animal products in moderation. Because you're already lean, you have no reason to think it doesn't work, mm-hmm. right? It works for you.
Mm-hmm. What you refer to this actually in the book as what you see is all there is thinking.
Yeah, this is a phrase that comes from the Nobel laureate, cognitive behavioral researcher, Richard Kahneman. What you see is all there is. Mm-hmm. And it's just, it's in his book, Thinking Fast and Slow. And it's whenever I'm trying to understand cognitive dissonance, why I believe one thing and somebody whose intelligence I respect believes something entirely different, the first thing I do is think, what are they seeing that I'm not seeing? And what am I seeing that they're not seeing? Mm-hmm. So, if you look at it from a scientific perspective, science begins with the awareness, the observation that you see something that doesn't agree with your belief system. So you have a hypothesis, what you believe, and then you see something that conflicts with that. So your hypothesis is we should all eat, if we all eat in moderation of fruits, vegetables, whole grains, etc., we'll all be lean just like I am. But if you're already lean, it's hard to see anything that will conflict with that. Mm-hmm. If you're gaining weight easily, as many of us are, most of us start to do eventually, and you could say, well, I'm already doing exactly what I'm supposed to do. And particularly if you have patience, so you're telling patients, eat in moderation, eat less, exercise more, the whole fruits, vegetables thing, and they're getting heavier, they're getting fatter, and they're becoming more and more diabetic with each passing year, you're likely to think, well, first you're going to think they're not taking my advice, and that's what the medical community believes.
They're non-compliant. Quote,
they are non, and then nobody follows a diet. So they give dietary advice that doesn't work, and then when the people get fat anyway, they assume that nobody follows a diet because they're all getting fat anyway, rather than question their advice. But if the same thing happens to you, and you know you're following the advice, now you've got a conflict. Now you've got the observation that has to be either the hypothesis is wrong or the observation is wrong, and you could trust your observation. So now you start questioning the hypothesis. Maybe my advice sucks. Maybe I'm given the wrong advice. Maybe it's not that every patient I have is non-compliant. Maybe they're actually following the advice too, and it's failing them. It's clearly failing them, whether it's because they can't follow it or because it doesn't work, even if they do follow it. And now you have, Malcolm Gladwell described this as a conversion experience because he made fun in 1998. He did a piece on obesity for The New Yorker, one of his first pieces ever for The New Yorker. And he kind of made fun of the fact that every diet book doctor tells a story like this. But the point is, if you don't have this experience, then there's no book to be written. There's no revelation to be had. And in our field, I had this, I got into this research as a journalist. So I had no biases when I began. I had been eating, we discussed off air, I'd been living in Los Angeles, in Venice, by the beach. I'd been eating a very low-fat, mostly plant diet and working out an hour a day.
You were just a stone's throw from the Pritikin Institute, which was the temple of low-carb eating. Low-fat eating and,
low-fat. And a stone's throw from a slightly shorter stone's throw from Gold Gym, mm-hmm. and the Venice Boardwalk, and what we did back then was eat very low fat diets and mostly plant diets, and you know, I assumed this was the healthiest way to eat. When I was gaining 2 pounds a year in my 30s, I just assumed this is the best I can do. And then I did, when I was reporting the second of my investigative articles on nutrition, this one for the journal Science, it was on dietary fat, economist at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. I was also simultaneously writing an article for a different publication on the mathematics of the stock market. This is the life of a freelance journalist. Anyway, this economist told me that if I was writing about fat, I had to try Atkins. That's what keto was called before it became keto. He said his collaborator was at Wharton Business School, and his collaborator's father lost 200 pounds on Atkins. So he said he did it. He's Asian American. He lost 40 pounds. He said he basically gave up white rice. So I had, at the time, I was unmarried. My parents had passed away. I had no children. I figured if the diet kills me, nobody really care all that much. Maybe my landlord. So I tried it as an experiment. And I switched from this very health, what I thought was a very healthy, low-fat, mostly plant diet to a eggs and bacon for breakfast and, you know, half a roast chicken or a steak with a salad or vegetables for lunch and the same thing for dinner and very large portion sizes. And I just went all out. And I lost 25 pounds in 6 weeks, so much so that I stopped doing any aerobic exercise whatsoever, because I had been doing all the aerobic exercise right to burn off the calories I was consuming, or so I thought, so that I could continue to eat to satiety. Now I could eat to satiety, and they seem to lose weight anyway. So it's this sort of, well, scientists would use the term anomalous observation. It made zero sense in the context of the nutritional understanding of the era.
Well, and I was going to chime in that conventional nutritionists would say that you need carbs for muscle and brain. They're the preferred fuel for the body's energy metabolism. So
yeah,
how do we reconcile
that? Well, the line you get is we need about 125 grams a day of carbohydrates to fuel the brain, and they are the primary fuel for the brain if you are eating a carbohydrate-rich diet. So this is where the nutritionists stop, and yet the textbooks will describe this correctly, and even the government documents will describe this correctly. There's a dietary reference intakes guide that was put out, 2 volumes, in which they point out that if you're not eating carbohydrates, so for instance, if you fast for several days, your brain doesn't shut down because you don't have carbs in your diet. Your body just takes the fat that you start burning and converts the fat, your liver converts the fat to ketones, and it converts some of the protein is broken down into amino acids, and now you can fuel the brain on a mixture of about 75% ketones, 25% glucose from either the protein or also from the glycerol that's released when triglycerides are released from the fat tissue and broken down into fatty acids and glycerol.
This is what's termed the switch. The switch happens when you make that change the proportion of macronutrients, and your metabolism goes to some like a kind of a primitive reserve metabolism that humans have evolved because there were times of feast and there were times of famine, and sometimes we had to draw down our fat stores.
Well, we also did not have carbohydrate-rich diets until the advent of agriculture, 5,000-10,000 years ago. So for the first 2 million years of our evolution, we were living primarily on protein and fat. So the argument is, and by the 1960s, researchers had worked out that they knew that a carbohydrate-restricted diet was metabolically a little different than fasting, because in both cases, your body is using protein and fat for fuel and getting by perfectly well on protein and fat for fuel. And this may indeed have been sort of the preferred metabolic state for the 2 million years of evolution. So one thing I discuss in the book, and that sort of continues to mystify me, despite what's going on sort of 20 years of thinking about this, when you look at the textbooks, the understanding of fat metabolism, fat storage, and the hormonal enzymatic regulation of both took until 1960 before a technology was available that allowed it to happen. This was the radioimmunoassay that allowed endocrinologists to measure hormone levels in the blood accurately. That caused a revolution in medicine. Rosalind Yalow won the Nobel Prize for her part.
Radioimmune assays, that whole thing, right?
Yeah, her colleague Solomon Burson passed away, so he didn't get it. But by the 1960s, researchers now pretty much understood the hormonal enzymatic regulation of fat tissue, and it was insulin plays a dominant role. So virtually every the hormone in the body works to get fat out of the fat tissue because the hormones are telling your body to do something. They're causing some effect, and they work to make the fuel available for that effect to happen, whether it's fleeing or fighting or reproducing or growing or repairing cells. So one hormone works against that. One hormone dominates fat storage and the use of fat for fuel, and that's the hormone insulin. So when you secrete insulin, you store fat, and when insulin drops, you mobilize fat, and your lean tissue will burn it for fuel. And this is textbook medicine. And the other aspect of textbook medicine, which is the medical community, the obesity research community, paid almost zero attention to any of this, because by this time they had decided that obesity was caused by eating too much. Mm-hmm. So they saw any hormonal explanation as an excuse for fat people to not do what thin people like them did naturally. Mm-hmm. So they ignored the physiology, which said insulin is a dominant hormone. Even though people like Yalow and Burson said, look, insulin is the most lipogenic hormone. So maybe a little bit of insulin dysregulation, a little bit of diabetes, in effect, causes obesity, not the other way around. Mm-hmm. George Cahill, who's a lead, I didn't put this in the book because I regrettably didn't read this article until after the book was done. I read it for the book I'm working on now, which is on diabetes. So George Cahill is the leading metabolism researcher in the United States in the 1960s. He's at Harvard. When he leaves Harvard, he goes on to be the science director for the Howard Hughes Medical Institute. Cahill is renowned for his studies of long-term studies of fasting, in which he demonstrated that ketones were not pathological molecules, but were absolutely necessary for the function of the human brain when we're not eating carbohydrates. And he should have changed how the medical community thought about ketones and ketosis, but they didn't pay attention. Mm-hmm. And in the process,
think what stops a lot of doctors around this is they think that, you know, you hear about this ketogenic diet, and we've learned in medical school, we were well indoctrinated that one of the most disastrous things you encounter in medicine is diabetic ketoacidosis. So they tend to conflate the two things, thinking, oh my goodness, do we want to build up ketones in your bloodstream? That's what happens when diabetics end up in the intensive care unit, you know, at death's door.
And this is what's interesting about medicine is, again, I'm doing research now for a book on diabetes. I've been reading all the history. So just at the point insulin was discovered in 1921 and insulin therapy came in for diabetes, some physicians at the University of Michigan had been testing, in effect, ketogenic diets for diabetes and reporting in the medical journals remarkable results. And it never caught on because once you started getting insulin therapy, you needed carbs in your diet to balance the insulin. And Elliot Joslin, who was the god of diabetes, had the Joslin Diabetes Center, who was seeing an order of magnitude more patients than anyone else, and he was writing the textbooks, was always scared that you know, the high-fat diet would precipitate diabetic coma, ketoacidosis. And other physicians were scared about this also, while simultaneously you had researchers, particularly in Germany and Austria, saying there's a dramatic difference between diabetic ketoacidosis and what, you know, we're now calling ketosis, which are low levels of ketones, comparatively low levels, that you get in very natural, you know, you get either during fasting or when eating a carbohydrate-restricted diet. And by the 1960s, one of the things Cahill pointed out is that the ketones you produce feeds back on the pancreas to inhibit or to regulate insulin secretion so that nutritional ketosis cannot develop into diabetic ketoacidosis. Mm-hmm. But none of this is communicated to the physicians in the field, who learn basically, you know, one slice of 40-year-old science when they go to medical school.
Yeah,
and then they hold
in
on
a very
to
cursory way. You know, frankly, we sort of get kind of a Classics Illustrated version of biochemistry on our way to becoming basically drug prescribers. That's kind of the summation of medical school education. Okay, we're going to pause for a moment because we divide our podcast into two parts. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Our guest is Gary Taubes, author of a great new book. It's really important if you want to understand the keto diet, The Case for Keto, Rethinking Weight Control and the Science and Practice of Low-Carb, High-Fat Eating. And we'll return with some more, a practical look at how we might implement a keto diet. This is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.